on the radio. Joey Reynolds Show.
We got a guy named Ron Miller here who's on a spiritual journey. But this is not you on the front page here. Is that
no,
you?
No.
Are you the happy cannibal?
I'm not the happy cannibal, no.
Who's this? Who's this guy?
I took that picture when I was on my first journey around the world. That was taken in Kathmandu, Nepal.
Uh-huh.
And the guy really caught my attention. At that time, I was much more naive. And those gurus with their very powerful, penetrating stares, they had quite an impact on me. But there's quite a little bit of a story behind that where I took the picture. He wasn't looking at me at the time. If everybody out there just imagine the most powerful stare you've ever seen.
Well, it looks like Bin Laden.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
What it looks like.
I'm sure he probably has a stare like that as well.
Yeah.
And he penetrated me. And as I took the photo, I thought, man, I should have asked beforehand for his picture. But I didn't want him to know that he had kind of gotten into me. So I walked down the trail a little bit. But I want to look back because I know this guy's still looking at me. I just sensed it. But I didn't want him to know he had this control over me. So I got down to the next guru, turned over and looked, and just casually looked back up in his direction. Sure enough, that same stare was looking at me. They've got a very powerful spiritual side to them. I don't know if it's for good or bad, but
it's serenity.
They
look like they're at peace because they don't really have much going on. There's no television.
You know, they give everything up. To follow the path to enlightenment, that's for sure.
Oh, they don't have Fox, so they're not aggravated. They're you know, I mean, you can have serenity when you're not bugged by everybody telling you what you ought to think.
Or the latest on Joan Benet, that's kind of crazy, isn't it?
That's telling you what you ought to think.
Yeah.
The guy who made himself famous, you mean, last week.
Yeah.
The man who twisted the media. I think that should be examined somewhere along the line, right? It's the disease of fame with how important it is to be famous. More important to be famous than it is to have anything else in your life.
Well, I think it's more compelling of how pitiful our media is today. And another thing that you hear the pundits talking about that, and nobody wants to hold him accountable, even just for what he's done, you know, forcing our justice system to bring him across here, he should be held accountable and as an example.
He should go to jail for that.
Absolutely.
Or maybe be caned, because that's what they do over in Thailand.
They do that in Thailand. They do that in Singapore. Yeah. And you know, that's
a good caning.
There's nothing wrong with a little corporal punishment.
You can sleep with a little kid, but you can't steal something. Because if you steal something, your arm gets... Don't they take a hand off or something like that?
They do in the Muslim parts of the world. Yes.
What's an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth?
And a hand for stealing, yes.
So they do that. They still punish people that way, taking a hand?
They do, yes.
Yeah.
A number of places in the world. And it's an interesting lead in there with... A lot of people think that if you went to a sort of a biblical justice system, you're going to be cutting people's hands off. But actually, in the Bible, the punishment for stealing is a bit more fair and just. If someone steals and is caught, but they haven't turned themselves in, they have to pay double what they stole.
Yeah.
If they've stolen and felt guilty, turned themselves in, they pay 20% more. What they stole plus 20% restitution. But a lot of people think that the Judeo-Christian roots that we have in this country, that it would be barbaric like we see in the Muslim part of the world, but that's not the case.
No. And I think also Enron, how would they ever pay back?
Yeah. That you could never get
even
the
if
money
they confessed
back from there.
20% of it.
Yeah.
So there's some things that we didn't have corporate crime in the Bible.
Yeah.
It was singular. Now we have consortiums. You got people who have organized.
Right.
We didn't have organized crime, did we, in the Bible? Did we have the mafia then? No, I don't think so. We'll be right back. The Joey Reynolds Show, live from New York. Ron Miller's here. Ron Miller's here. He wrote The Escape from the Happy Cannibal, A Journey of the Soul. So how many books you written?
This is my first book.
Yeah. What did you do? Go out on a trip and decided to put out a book with pictures?
Well, actually, my journey was a bit spiritual and a bit cultural, and I thought originally when I started traveling that it was simply to see the beautiful landscapes in the world. For me, that would have been enough. But there was a more important reason. When I began traveling, I was really, really intrigued by culture. And I realized that if I were born in Germany, I would be a different Ron Miller. If I were born in Sumatra, I would be a much different Ron Miller. And to me, that was very disturbing because I thought I was my own self-made man, sort of like a John Wayne and Clint Eastwood all put together. But I had to admit that my culture had shaped me somewhat, and it disturbed me because I thought that I should be shaped by a source of guidance that should supersede the culture I just happened to be born into. And that's what I was looking for, was that guidance that should supersede culture.
So where did you begin?
I began traveling in Europe. And
No, I mean in your journey.
In my spiritual journey.
By traveling.
Yeah. Well,
where are you from?
I'm from Knoxville, Tennessee.
All right.
And
were you a minister or something?
No, I was an environmental engineer, not a school teacher.
I had no idea.
Yeah. And
so you saved your money and you went traveling.
Yeah. I took a few ski trips to Europe, and I was intrigued by culture, and it was drawing me into the world because what I realized is that I would have to go out there and find those experiences that would pull out what I've been given to know. And so I had to step out of my comfort zone and my repetitive lifestyle and go out there in the world. And it was culture that most intrigued me. And what I was discovering is that we are all shaped by culture. And individually, it's a very powerful force. And then collectively, it is instrumental in shaping society. And all of the social and economic ills in the world, I think, are tied to culture, whether it's poverty, tyranny, or corruption. And if we really want to combat those social ills, we need to look at culture and view the world from the cultural perspective.
Sometimes the only culture I have in my life is yogurt. I mean, so what is culture? Culture is that which everybody agrees is what we're going to do. You know, American words are different than just English words. American words usually take on more meanings.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the force that works through mankind, and it shapes us, and it puts into us some values before we really know what's going on. And it's not until we're a little bit older we can become more introspective and compare what the world has put into us with maybe our innermost values. And I think that's really the most important journey that we must go on, is to that introspective journey and rise above the culture we just happen to be born into.
So what's culture? What is it?
Well,
we're going to be beating this one with a stick,
yeah.
Aren't we?
It's the main point of my book, and
yeah. But what is culture? I mean, culture is Boy George calls it Culture Club. I mean, it's an organization of people who have the same beliefs.
Well, it's that societal force that shapes individuals and collectively entire societies.
All right, so people agree on doing something. They agree on having some sort of a special style, or they all have the same interests in mind. Is that it?
Yes, for the most part.
Yeah. So when did you discover this?
Well,
when you were working, did you have a job and you thought, gee, I want to join something?
Well, I was looking for actually my connection to my Creator. That was the ultimate purpose for my journey. And I think it follows in line with really the mission of Christ, which was that we should be more than the culture we just happened to be born into. You know, one of the last things Christ did with his disciples at the Last Supper was instruct them that eat this bread, this is my body, and drink this wine, this is my blood. And if you think about what he was trying to, the image he was creating in their mind, it was that they were cannibals and they were vampires, and it's very repulsive. And I think the reason for that is he was attempting to break that link between them and their culture so that they can take on the new covenant that Christ was offering.
Well, what culture were you born into?
The American culture. And
is everybody in America the same?
Well, there are many subcultures, and the two cultures that influenced me most, the Judeo-Christian cultural ethics, but also the sort of the locker room culture, which instills the value that it's acceptable to use women in the wrong way, and You know, if you don't, you're hardly a man. So I kind of had both of those two cultural backgrounds that were influencing me, and I realized that neither one of them was satisfactory, and I had to find that guidance that I refer to as the wisdom that's within the innermost man that we all share.
All right. So you decided to go on a trip.
Right.
And you went where?
I began in Europe, as most people do, and had the round-the-world ticket. And gradually I would move into the more, what I perceived were more dangerous countries because they had more disparate cultures, and it was a much better environment for learning. And I realized that the risks, although they weren't as significant as I thought they were initially, were worth traveling. It was worth traveling into those countries because of the rewards of what I learned.
And you learned what?
Well, I learned that our ultimate source of guidance, it's not in a book, it's not in a sermon, it's not out there, it's within us. And I think a very important passage that touches on this is in the Gospel of Thomas, where Christ is reported to have said, "Bring forth that which is within you, and what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth that which is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you."
And it means what to you?
Well, it means that our ultimate guidance is within, and it's not in the things of the world, the false attraction of the world. It's very, very deceptive. And I think another very common trap that man gets into is the original sin, which is the knowledge of good and evil. And if you think about what was that sin, it's not knowledge. It's man's wrong relationship with the knowledge of good and evil. It's an egotistical relationship. And what I see so often in the various religions is a continuation of that, that we think by studying that we are imbibing the Gospels or whatever religious writings and that we are getting eternal life from them. But it's again, we're playing God. It's an egotistical exercise.
All right, we're going to take a little break here. Escape from the Happy Cannibal is a journey of the soul for Ron Miller. This is his own personal journey here. He was working with, he was environmentally ill down in Tennessee and decided to go on a world tour, and he's back. And this is his first book. We'll be right back. Ron Miller's here, he's a spiritual world traveler. Geez, who paid for your trip?
Well, I've always been very frugal, and sometimes I look back and it amazes me that I've been able to travel as I have. It's all from an engineer's salary.
You saved?
I saved.
Did you spend it all?
Just about.
And then you came
home?
Exercise. You didn't put it on your car?
No,
nobody got your PIN number, did they?
No. I would basically travel for about a year, and I realized that it was time, for some crazy reason, I would think it's time to get back into the work environment. And I'd work for a couple of years, and then I'd go off and travel.
Did you travel come back again to this country to work, or always?
Yes, I always came back and went back into my field because it was the most lucrative. I'd get the most money, and then I could go out and travel again.
Sounds like you've outsourced God. So what happened with you with this trip to Tibet? Did you go up there to Nepal and Tibet? And that part of the world seems very holy.
Spiritual and so forth. Well, I came away with actually the opposite impression. I had traveled significantly with the monks, going to some of the pilgrimage sites and so forth. And I found that really they were just products of their culture. And we all are to a certain degree. And it goes back to one of the most important lessons I learned is that I'm not going to find truth in any pilgrimage sites unless I find it first within myself.
So when you were up in the mountains where the ashrams are and the monks, you didn't feel any more spiritual, no closer to God?
I never did, no. And I think that's a blessing. That's a gift to realize that it's not outside of you. You know, even
the Holy Land. Have you been to the Holy Land?
Yeah.
I've been holy?
To Israel. Not to me, no. It's
not holy.
It really isn't, no.
It's a wholly-owned subsidiary by an oil company, it seems. That's as holy as it gets, Wholly.
Mm-hmm.
So are you intrigued with anything in particular that surprised you? Was there some place that you thought was particularly great or different? Or
the most powerful experience for me was early on in my travels. I went to Ukraine. I have relatives in Ukraine. My paternal grandparents immigrated back in the late 20s. And so I was the first one to go back to this part of the world. And as I traveled into the area, of course, in 1991 was still the Soviet Union, and I feared I was going to be shunned. I can only imagine the anti-American propaganda that my relatives were subjected to. And I showed up completely unannounced on their doorstep. And I was fortunate to have run into a gentleman to act as my interpreter. And we arrive at the doorstep of the only relative that I knew of at the time. I had his picture and address. And if you can imagine, that looking back at the past history in that part of the world, a Soviet citizen simply having a relative overseas might subject them to being sent to a gulag or even worse, and let alone having contact with that relative. So here I arrive, and my interpreter goes up to my relative and tells him who I am, but I see this very fearful expression as if we're part of a cagey plot or something. He's very suspicious. And then we show him a picture he had sent to an aunt back here in North America. And then right away that fear dropped off of his face. And it was at that point when I realized, hey, I'm going to have to be proactive here. And do I reach out my hand as a polite gesture? And I received quite a surprise when he reached out to me, gave me a bear hug, and planted a noisy, nasty, sucking kiss square on my lips. It was sort of a Ukrainian old country greeting that I was not prepared for.
It's called a holy kiss. It's in the scriptures.
Well, the scary thing is that I actually traveled...
Keep his tongue in his mouth, though.
No. Yeah. But I actually traveled back 4 times to Ukraine since then, and, you know, not that there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah. Well, I've been there. I just got back from Russia, so I was in the Baltics just there recently.
Yeah, I heard of your trips, and I know it made a significant impact on you, and it's nothing like traveling to go and see different parts of the world where people think a little bit differently, have some different perspectives, and it's a tremendous opportunity to look back and reflect on your own culture.
I was just in San Francisco over the weekend where they also kiss on the lips, but that was a different thing. It was a good experience, you know, mm-hmm. to meet people on the West Coast who are very much against the war,
mm-hmm.
don't know what to do, and yet have a strident economy. You know, we're all pretty much the same, as you say. It's a culture club. It is a culture club,
right? And I think it's very important that we understand this the significant impact of culture in terms of racism, for instance, when you look around the world, you see these links between poverty and race and social behavior that we might look at as somewhat unacceptable here, and it's often associated with race. And naturally, without any further understanding, we're going to think that the cause is racial.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an important message I like to share, is that we need to look at it from the cultural point of view, and you realize that people are shaped by their culture, and their behavior is an extension of their culture. And realizing that, you won't default to race, and you realize there's some promise that we can all work toward that common culture. And then other situations in the world, we're having problems, a cultural conflict in the Middle East. And we have to understand, again, that that's not racial, because if we think that, well, Middle Easterners, we can never get along with them, then there's no positive outcome. But if we look at it from the racial perspective, we can go in and attack the cultural component that is the root cause. You know, there's so many of us striking at the branches, and few of us that are attacking the roots.
Well, are you satisfied with yourself right now?
Yes, I am very satisfied. I didn't realize when I was traveling that I was looking for anything, and it wasn't until I found you ran
into yourself.
Yeah. There's so many quotes that really reflect on that. The one that I think is the most powerful is from Rabindranath Tagore, is an Indian playwright, and he said that The traveler must knock on every alien door before coming to his own. And the traveler must venture across all of the outer worlds before reaching the innermost shrine at the end. And that is the epitome of my journey.
Well, I got a spiritual one, too. The traveler must not carry shampoo on the airplane.
And
I had lip gloss, and I got away with it. I don't know how that ever happened. Boy, I would have been busted big time yesterday.
Well, being from Tennessee, the airline gave me a courtesy call reminding me that to travel to New York, I'd have to put shoes on.
Oh, yeah.
So what happens? I arrive at the airport, and I have to take
them off.
Yeah, what's up with that?
Well, that's where Davy Crockett's from.
Yes.
Wasn't he?
Yes.
Wasn't he a Tennessee rugrat?
Yeah, he was from East Tennessee, my stomping grounds.
And wore a coonskin cap.
Yeah, I just traveled down one of the rivers there, Nowichucky River, by his house, and yeah, he's one of the famous Tennesseans.
Well, up there in the Smoky Bear Mountains, you know. You ever been to Coker Creek?
Yes, over where the copper mines were.
Yeah. That's an exciting area. You won't have to go to Europe for that one.
Yeah, there's a lot of
handicrafts. They make handicrafts there.
Mm-hmm. A lot of devastation there is interesting from those copper mines. You had real acid rain there.
Yeah.
And it destroyed the vegetation. And for a long time, you could see this whole area from outer space. It was quite devastated. But it's growing back, and there's a very popular whitewater stream there. And Olympic events were held there in Atlanta not too long ago. So it's recovered.
Up in Knoxville, they have a radio station called WATE.
Yes.
And they used to have, they call it
well, actually a television station.
Yeah, a TV station. They call it the Great Weight Show. Remember instead of the Great Late Show, it was a Great Wait Late Show or something like that. I always laughed. But that's a good part of the country, pretty much the McCoys and the that was Kentucky, right? Where the feuds were going on?
The Hatfields and McCoys, actually in West Virginia.
Was it West Virginia?
West Virginia, yeah. Yes.
I know that there's a lot of moonshine where you're from. Where do they make that stuff that you like, Tony? What's that, Jim Beam?
Yeah.
Is that Tennessee Mash? Isn't that what it is?
Well, Jack Daniels. That's
Jack Daniels, yeah, that's the one.
An interesting thing, when you travel overseas, and in my case, I tell them I'm from Tennessee, what do they say? They say, oh, Jack Daniels, Lynchburg. And I never made that connection, but that's a very big marketing, bit of marketing overseas. They play up the small country town, Lynchburg, Tennessee, and all the people around the world knew of Lynchburg, but except for myself.
Well, they had this booze over. Tony didn't have that at his wedding because he got married in Kansas. And he got married in a church and had the reception in the church. But they were sneaking that stuff in. They had that. What did they have that in? It wasn't the alder wine. Get out. What was it, the flask? Oh, flask.
Well, I was different in many ways. One of those, 29 years old, had never drank hard liquor.
Yeah.
So here I traveled to Ukraine. And as you know, in Russia, that's a big part of their society.
Yeah. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yes. But I knew it was too important to turn down. But there I am arriving, this relative, and I'm treated like a king, but they pour the shot glasses, and I'm telling you, this stuff, I know where they got the secret formula for the Soyuz rockets now. It's this.
You could sing You Light Up My Life.
Yeah. It's this backyard vodka there in Ukraine.
Yeah.
But their tradition requires you to drink a round, and then you eat food, supposedly to counteract what you've just drank.
You know,
that's the logic of the
ceremony. And then you have some more for dessert.
Yeah.
Well, Tony, I'll tell you what his grandmother did at the wedding. She sneaked it in. You know, we had that Tennessee Mash. What is it again? What's that stuff again?
That name Jack Daniels?
Yeah, Jack Daniels.
Yeah.
She made a cake out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that? We'll be right back. The Joey Reynolds Show is live from New York. Traveler, I'm laughing deliriously because I've been away. You know, I came back, they fired two guys. I'm glad I was the hell out of here. One guy? Well, I was the other one, but they missed me? See, I told you it was a good thing I was out of here. No, you know, when you go away for a while and you come back, you really appreciate what you got when you come back if you had something good to begin with. If you didn't have anything good to begin with, then it doesn't matter anyway. Who wants to come back? But I came back, and I'm realizing how good I got here, you see. So I may never travel again. I'm going to glue my butt to this chair.
Well, you know, what makes for a good traveler in some ways is not really missing what you had at home. And not to belittle my family or anything, but I could just travel. But once I come back, then I realize some of the things I was missing. And the thing that I thought was the most striking was cornbread. You know,
oh, yeah.
Mom's cornbread. They're there was something I didn't think about, but boy, it sure tasted good after a year being away.
And the barbecue.
Yeah.
See, we always comes down to food and drink, don't it? I mean, you know, you could do these shows. I've done how many of these we did? 10 years of this, and we're always down to the food, aren't we? Isn't that ridiculous? That's a culture, mm-hmm. isn't it? I mean, what do we have? But what, some of it is lame, you know, the McDonald's and Burger King and all of that stuff. That's lame. That's and then there's the other kind. What do they call it? Comfort foods. Comfort foods. But I like the regular American stuff. Don't you?
You will like what you grow up eating. And
that's right. Exactly.
One of the things that I noticed traveling overseas, I always appreciated the local culture, the local foods.
Yeah.
But then if you come upon a McDonald's, for instance, I traveled in Turkey way back in 1992 for about a month, and then I get back into Istanbul. That's the only McDonald's in town. I don't care that much for McDonald's, but it sure tasted good. And as I say, the most dangerous place overseas is between a homesick American and the nearest McDonald's.
Yeah, the difference is there you had a hamburger in Turkey, and here you have turkey at a hamburger place. But, you know, I was thinking about having the thing that I really admire the most. When I went to overseas, I had pork tartare. It was really striking. Just a joke. There's no such thing as pork tartare, please. It's raw pork. No, we have a happy cannibal, you're calling yourself, right? The escape from the happy cannibal.
Yes.
Who would be the happy cannibal?
The happy cannibal would be anybody that is comfortable in their culture. And as I've said here a couple of times, I think our goal, our purpose, is to go beyond our culture and to be more than just a happy cannibal.
Yeah.
You know, the ultimate cultural question is, if you were born in a society of cannibals, would you question that society's values and behaviors? Would you challenge them? Or would you just be a happy cannibal? And what I find so interesting when I ask people this question, a lot of times they haven't thought about it, but many have. And they immediately answer, "Oh, I'd be a happy cannibal." But then, and then some within that group, they'll be a little bit disturbed because they'll realize that makes them just nothing more than a product of culture. And I think we should be more than that.
We are, whether you think it or not, we are. There's a personal choice, and then there's a world that keeps moving no matter whether you volunteer or not. You may as well volunteer because the job's going to get done anyhow. That's synchronicity. That's nature. That's God. I mean, that's the way it goes. Things get done. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed?
Yeah.
That if you sign off or you don't participate, it gets done anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Do you notice there's always someone to pick up the slack or do the job, unlike the post office or the motor vehicle? Mm-hmm. I mean, things do get done in this world, in the whole world, don't they?
Yeah. Well, I actually having some good experiences with the post office. I think I might have to change some of my theories about government service.
Well, they've done a better job. I'm just using it as a foil because it's
and
a
it,
joke.
And it shows you that it's the competition that has forced them to improve, you know, with UPS,
with Federal Express.
Federal Express, yeah.
Well, UPS is a little bit more profitable, I think. I think it's a real profitable company. Mm-hmm. Now, where are you working? Do you have a job or are you just an author now? Not that it's a bad thing.
As an author, and I'm attempting to share this message. I think it's very, very important.
But you're not doing environmental work anymore.
No, I'll go back to that perhaps eventually.
What do you think about global warming? You must think about that. There's something scriptural about that.
Yeah, well, it's a bit of a trade-off. You know, we've got all these fossil fuels. If we decide we want – it's a trade-off. We've got pollution. You know, here down in Tennessee, it's very noticeable because of where we're located in the southeast. If the winds come out of the north, we get the pollution from the north, and if it comes out of the south, we get it from the south. So it's very concentrated there in the summertime, and it's a trade-off. I hear a lot of people, they want to reduce emissions, but you know, where do we draw the line? Some people might want to go back and live a horse and buggy existence. So it is a decision we have to make based on values, and I think that a lot of the motivation for those who are trying to combat global warming, it's a bit more political. They dislike the free market and capitalism, and that's their way to combat that.
I think Arnold Schwarzenegger made an announcement today, governor of California, as a governor, not as the Terminator. And he gave some sort of a compliance with the Democrats and the Republicans getting together. Of course, he's a Democrat gone Republican anyway, I think, because of the nature of his family, you know, the Kennedys, marrying into the Kennedys. Well, so whatever you call it, a Demokin or a Republicrat, it doesn't matter what it's called. But those guys are now trying to get their act together so that we can solve some problems and maybe be able to breathe again.
Well, it is a problem, and as far as global warming, I'm less concerned about the warming side of it as I am the pollution. That is a problem. But as you were talking, I thought about something. Maybe it would be a good thing for the government to say, well, we're going to reduce the output because they're not very successful at actually getting things done. So maybe it won't happen after all. But if it seriously is a problem that we need to deal with, then I would be willing myself to sign on to the cutbacks. But I'm not so sure that it really is a problem.
Did you see things overseas that you thought where you thought they were taking care of themselves better than we take care of ourselves here?
In the Scandinavian countries, I don't know what it is about their culture. Even with a welfare society, it's not abused there. And maybe it's that the work ethic is so ingrained in their culture that it's not abused. But the cleanest cities
Finland.
Yeah, yeah. Finland, Norway, Sweden,
and Denmark.
They're all identical. Right, yeah. And even when you go across the border up to the north in Canada, where my father's from, the cities are much cleaner, and there again, that's a cultural value.
And we got a garbage truck going by every half minute here. So what's going on? Where are we putting this stuff? On the other side of the street? I think we're doing alternate street garbage. That's what it is. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, it goes on this side, then we move it over to the other side. It doesn't seem like it's going, does it? We make a lot of garbage here.
Well, that's one of the cultural values I first encountered. I grew up, was born and raised up until the age of 10 in Miami, Florida. And then we moved up to Tennessee, where my mother was from. But my mother's relatives lived out in the countryside, where there was no concept of placing garbage in its proper location. And so every little corner of the road, you'll see where they'll just go and dump their garbage. And the street signs are shot up and so forth. And, you know, there again, it's a culture that the values we may not admire, and it shows really when you go back to the immigration in that part of the world. You had the immigrants that were coming in more of from the high country in Scotland, which had a much more backward culture, and that's what you saw in a lot of Appalachia. Whereas the folks coming from the lowlands, they settled in the lowland areas in East Tennessee, where there was much better soil, and you see those two different cultures right there living together in East Tennessee.
When I was a kid, we used to burn leaves on the lawn. And that was always a nice, crisp fall smell. That's how we got rid of the leaves back then. Of course, then eventually we smoked them, got high. But, you know, was never a good buzz. Not buffalo. Buffalo trees are not, you don't even get off on them too much. Anyway, I want to thank you, Ron Miller, spiritual world traveler, author of Escape from the Happy Cannibal. And Ron's on the road with this picture of this man with dreadlocks. That's not you, is it?
That's not me, although most, even my friends will ask.
Yeah, well, I just wonder. I've seen this before in Jamaica, man. Thank you. You come back, it's safe. Ron Miller, Escape from the Happy Cannibal, A Journey of the Soul. Be right back on the Joey Reynolds Show from New York City. And Adam and Eve, I guess they were the inventors of the loose leaf system. We'll be right back.